Okay. Let me set my levels real quick. This is Sarah Milligan. I'm in Mount Sterling, Kentucky. It's February 23rd, 2008, and I'm interviewing, are you Jim or James?
I went in the Navy as Jimmy. My father named me Jimmy after my Uncle Jimmy Browning, my great-uncle Jimmy Browning. But I didn't, some way or another, the doctor didn't register me. And after I went to work at the post office, I could get my birth certificate, and I adopted two of my great uncles' names, James Woodson Browning. So James W. Browning is my proper name.
I'm interviewing James W. Browning.
There you go.
He'll let us know what he wants to be called. And Belinda Cook is sitting in with us to learn a little bit about oral history, and so she may have some questions she wants to input. So tell me, how did all this start? When did you start with World War II? What's your career?
Well, I had two brothers in the Coast Guard, and the Coast Guard was a different group before World War II. And then when the war came along, they were officially part of the Navy. And then I had a brother that was drafted and went into the Navy in 1943. So I had three brothers in the Navy, and I was bored with high school. I was a senior and wanted to get out of high school any way I could. And so I, in October the 28th, 1944, I went to Louisville and enlisted in the Navy.
Where did you grow up?
Where did I grow up? Here in Mount Sterling.
In Mount Sterling.
I was born in Florida, but my father went down there during boom time in the 20s, and I was born down there. And when things busted, he came back to Kentucky.
What year were you born?
26. 1926. And so I don't even remember living in Florida. So I grew up here. I never went anyplace else. And I was sworn in. I was always easy to remember. I went to boot camp in Great Lakes, Illinois. I was sworn in on November the 11th, which was Armistice Day then. It's Veterans Day now. And I took 10 weeks training at Great Lakes. And I'm going to show off my memory now. Uh-huh. In Company 2107, the Green Bay section of Great Lakes, Barracks 2702. The 21st Regiment.
It's pretty good.
I'm not sure about the regiment, but the rest of it I am.
1944.
Yeah, so I went to 10 weeks. And in the middle of the winter, Great Lakes, right down on the lakes, Lake Michigan. And it was cold. I want to tell you, it was cold. But it did get us out of a lot of drilling, you know. But I never did mind close order drill and stuff like that. But one day we went over for anti-aircraft on the lakeside, and we just about froze to death. It was about 5 miles over there. But we were there for 10 weeks, and I was talking to another fellow out there just a while ago that took his training up there, too. We had wooden floors in the barracks, of course, and we had black-soled shoes with big black marks on the floor. And we cleaned them by taking steel wool pads and putting them under our shoes and scrubbing them like that.
Putting it on the sole of your shoe and walking
and
around.
They called it the Great Lake Shuffle. And, of course, in an hour or two, with 100 and some men in the barracks, they were dirty again. I think it was just a contrived thing to keep people busy. Another interesting thing, we stood a lot of watch, a duty watch. We had a front door guard. And three or four of them around the barracks. And the rule was, I suppose, to teach us discipline, was if anybody that didn't wear legging, which the boots, that's what they called them in the Navy, we had to say sir to them. And that somebody would come in but didn't have boots on, he may have just been a petty officer, you know. And we'd have to salute and say, Company 2107 Front Door Guard reporting sir. Of course, it was just a contrived thing to teach us discipline. Mm-hmm. But after I was thinking about it this morning, right, human. After I graduated or got out of boot camp, but before I shipped out, of course I took my boots off, and I went down to another barracks to say goodbye. The morning I remembered well, say goodbye to him, and I didn't have my boots on, and I walked up the barracks, and that front door got somebody. So-and-so, front door guard reporting, sir. That's the only time I ever got saluted while I was in the Navy. But, of course, before we got out of boot camp, they interviewed us and felt like what we were suited for to go into, you know, what kind of training and stuff. Of course, some of them went straight to sea duty. right straight to sea duty. For some reason or other, they sent me to Aviation Ordnance School in Norman, Oklahoma. That's about as far from the ocean as you can get. So I took 20 weeks, 5 months of training. And of course, this is 1945. And we learned about machine guns, bombs and fuses, aerial targets, aviation ordnance was what it was. And just about the time, I think I got out in May, and they shipped me, we went down to Los Angeles and up to Alameda, California. And it was a permanent naval base up there. And it was a nice base. It had concrete barracks and nice chow halls. And it was just one of those permanent built probably 30 or 40 years before that. And I thought, well, boy, this is great. I spent 2 days checking in. We go around, take your papers and get checked in. And 2 days checking out. They took me and put me on the ship. And at Hunter's Point there in San Francisco.
Let me ask you something real quick.
Okay.
When you left boot camp, what was your exit interview? What kind of questions did they ask you to determine where you were going to go?
Of course, I don't remember the details of it, but they supposedly found out what you're most adept at is what the word I'm trying to say. And I guess if they couldn't find anything, they just sent you to sea duty, you know. We came out, of course, you went in as an apprentice seaman. Your dress uniform just had one stripe around the sleeve.
Okay.
And after you got out of boot camp, you got the second stripe around your sleeve. And then the third stripe was the third. And then, of course, after that, you got up to your shoulder, you know, like that. Shoulder, I went on your left arm. You got to be a petty officer then. Any other questions?
Did you choose the Navy because your brothers were in the Coast Guard?
Yes, guys, in that direction. I was just 17 years old. Almost 18. As I said, I enlisted the 28th of October, and then the 1st of November, I was 18 years old. I couldn't imagine now my father giving permission, or my mother and father giving me permission. I think about if I had a 17-year-old kid, I'm not sure that I would have done it.
But they did give you permission.
Yes, they did, yeah. And I went to... As I said, they transferred me to the ship USS Langley, an aircraft carrier.
Mm-hmm.
And in 1943, they realized that the aircraft carriers was a big thing. You know, it was an air war, World War II war. And they didn't realize that at first, and they couldn't build aircraft carriers fast enough. So they had some cruisers that were laid down and a hull up like that. And the CVLs, this is, CV means aircraft carrier, L was light, and ours was USS Fargo. Of course, cruisers are named after the capitals of states, you know.
Okay.
And USS Fargo, when it was laid up, it had been launched, just the hull, but it hadn't been finished on top. So they finished it up as an aircraft carrier. It was 640 feet long, and they were fast. They'd do 32 knots. But they only carried about 35 airplanes, and there were 9 or 10 of them in that class, which was the Independence class carrier. And but I enjoyed my sea duty. It gave you a feeling of individuality rather than being on a big base. You were on a ship with about 500 or 600 men. It made you feel more individual, I guess the word is. And we slept in a compartment. It wasn't a third as big as this room, and 85 sailors slept in there.
So maybe 20 by 30, maybe?
Maybe 40 by 40, maybe.
40 by 40.
Like that. And the bunks, the racks we call them, they folded up. And there would be 5 and 6 of them in a row. I mean, above like that, you know. And if you were lucky, if you got a bottom, got among it, you could just barely turn over it. And we were, the officers that slept up towards the front of the ship, officer's country, we called it, they had a few portholes up there. And we were one of the, our compartment had two portholes in it. That was one of the, it was up on what they call the poop deck. We had two portholes. We were proud of those portholes. But I got on a ship in June of 1945, and of course the war was over in 2 months. We went out on shakedown cruise had gotten out of dry dock. The Langley was in a lot of combat during before it came back in, and I think in about February or March of 1945. Am I talking too much for you?
No.
Okay. And they dry docked, complete overhaul, painted, everything like that. And they painted the inside of the water tanks. They refurbished it. And we went out on shakedown cruise for five days outside of San Francisco. Called it the potato patch out there because it's so rough. And of course, I'd never been to sea before. And that paint in the water to make coffee, who could hardly drink it in seasickness. I was seasick for 5 days, and my theory was I couldn't lose anything, couldn't upchuck anything if I didn't eat anything, and I about starved to death. But
was there a lot of people that were seasick the boat?
Oh, yeah, there was like that.
That was the first time you'd ever been to sea was on this, your okay. first time out.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And we went out there, and let's see, what else was I thinking to say? But I loved the ship. I'd go around and I'd go up on a family. We had some Marines on the ship. Every major ship in the Navy had Marines on it, I think just to give it a little class or something like that. And we kind of resented them because, of course, the chow lines were long like that, and the chow line went right through the Marines' compartment just before we went in. And they didn't have to stand. All they had to do was stand up.
Stand up. And it snaked all the way back around the ship.
And, they had a quad, four anti-aircraft guns on the bow of the ship. That's all they did. And it stood the captain to watch. That's about all they did. And sat around and polished their brass and things like that. We kind of resent them. They'd say, well, the Marines are part of the Navy. And we'd say, yeah, the worst part. Well, we went out and came back in. And finally, an interesting thing that happened to me, a fellow was 2 or 3 years older than I, Walter Johnson from here in Mount Sterling. He went to University of Kentucky and was a basketball player. He was only about 5 feet, 3 or 4, but that was before they had these 7 feet people. And he was a great basketball player, and he was drafted. And I was, before I went overseas, I went over to Oakland, California, which is an environment of, as you know, of San Francisco. I don't know what I was doing over by myself, and I'd walk down the street, and somebody says, "Hey, Browning." Looked around, it's Walter Johnson. He's leaning up against the side of a car there, and I said, "What in the world are you doing here?" And I said, "I'm waiting for Coco Jackson." That's another fellow I knew. And he's over at Alameda Naval Air Station out there, and waiting for him. We're supposed to eat here in this restaurant. Well, he never did. I talked to him a while. He never did. Coco never showed up. There were two restaurants by the same name. And he was at the other one. We went in and ate together. And I said, "What ship are you on, Walter?" And he said, "I'm on the Indianapolis." And I remember saying, "Is that a light cruiser or a heavy cruiser?" And he said, "One or the other." And we talked and visited a while. I went by the next day and saw Coco Jackson and visited him. And it didn't seem like it was a week or 10 days after that, we sailed to Pearl Harbor. And when I got to Pearl Harbor, I looked at a newspaper and the Indianapolis had been sunk. They were loading the pieces to the atomic bomb on it while we were talking. And they took the atomic bomb to the Pacific and dropped it on Japan. And that ship was going back from where they dropped the atomic bomb off back to Guam or one of the others, and was going from Guam back to the Philippines. And this is in August. The war just didn't last two or three more weeks. And went from one naval district or something like that to another, and probably the last Japanese submarine in the Pacific torpedoed that thing. And the Navy lost that ship. It went down. The sharks ate a lot of them, and Walter got killed. He was killed. And the sharks ate a lot of them, and the Navy wasn't even looking for the ship. I think they lost 800 men. Sharks, as I said, sharks ate a lot of them. And a Navy patrol plane came by, flew over, and saw an oil slick down there and started circling around and saw these people and went out there and rescued the ones that were left. And what did they do? They court-martialed the captain. And the captain, they kind of cleared him, but they ruined his reputation. And after the war, it weighed on his mind so much that he went out in his front yard and killed himself, you know.
Why did they court-martial him?
Said he wasn't zigzagging. And they brought the Japanese captain of the Japanese submarine to testify against him when they had the court-martial. And the captain of the Japanese submarine said, it didn't make any difference whether he's zigzagging or not. I'd have got him anyway. But anyway.
So how did they catch the Japanese submarine?
Huh?
How did they catch the Japanese submarine?
Well, it didn't get sunk after the war.
But they captured it.
No, the captain of it, I said.
The submarine.
Yeah.
Right.
It and the crew, Japanese crew, survived the war. But they brought him back to testify against the captain. And
so you were in Pearl Harbor while that happened.
We were operating out of Pearl Harbor
right.
like that. I was on Waikiki Beach when they announced the... Of course, they had a false armistice, or false end of the war. They did that in the First World War, too.
Tell me about that.
Well, there was a rumor got out that the Japanese had surrendered, and they hadn't. And two or three days later, they had. But I was on Waikiki Beach when they did surrender like that. They took us out. Am I telling you more than you want to know?
No, you're telling me what I want to know.
Okay. They took us off the ship. They had a lot of soldiers and sailors that were high time. They had been in since 1941, and they wanted out.
Yeah.
And they took our ship and took the air crew off, which I was part of, about 450 men, and got a bunch of cots and stuff and put on the hangar deck where we kept the plane down there, and made two trips to the United States, San Francisco, bringing those back, you know. And they took the air crew off and sent them out to Barber's Point. And the first morning we were out there, the next morning they mustered us down there and we picked up trash all over went out along the side of the road. Golly, this is the way it's gonna be for a month, you know. That's the last work we did. We had liberty every night. We could gone into Honolulu. We had two real nice beaches on the base. And we'd go out there and scuba dive, and we'd muster in the morning at 7 o'clock. You muster, you understand that term?
No.
Well, they roll call. And we had the whole day to ourselves. it was the best duty I had in the Navy. But anyway...
What was your job on the ship when you were out?
I really didn't do a whole lot. After the war was over, of course, there wasn't any use to fooling around machine guns and bombs and things like that. Not a whole lot. I stood good guard duty on the ship. I don't know who we were guarding against, because there wasn't any.
Is that what you did while the war was still active? Were you doing you a guard?
Yeah. Of course, I said we went overseas probably in June of 45, and then the war was over in August of 45. Not much of anything. And then finally, we... came back to the States in October of 45, came down and came through the canal, which was an experience, Panama Canal, and came up to Philadelphia for Navy Day of 1945. And then I came home on leave and then had orders to go to Memphis, Tennessee, at Naval Air Station down there, and I finished up my naval career down there.
What was your experience in Panama Canal?
Just interesting, you know. It's just interesting, and
explain that to me a little bit.
Well, I just finished reading a book on Teddy Roosevelt. Of course, he was instrumental in getting the canal built. One of the greatest engineering feats, you know, up until during the 20th century. The French had tried to build a canal, and the yellow fever had almost wiped them out, and we bought out their interest, and it was just quite an operation, you know, the lock going up through the locks and things like that. Teddy Roosevelt would have a fit if he were living to know that we gave the canal back to the Panama, but they apparently had done a pretty good job running it. I haven't heard anything out of it. But we came up to Navy Day at Philadelphia, and then Memphis, I didn't do anything much down there. just putting in time, waiting, and I got discharged the 11th day of July of 1946. And really, a few high points in my life. One of them was when I joined the Navy. One of them was when I got married. And the third one is when I went to work at the post office. I worked, used to be, after World War II, they had turned 10 million people, soldiers and sailors, back on the civilian market. And jobs were scarce, very scarce. And my brother and I both took the civil service examination. Back in those days, they don't do it anymore. I don't know why they didn't, haven't, because they should have. A veteran got 5 points when he took his civil service examination. Got 5 points as a disabled veteran, he got 10 points. That was fair, a little reward for people that serve. They don't do it anymore. I don't know why they don't. Mm. But anyway, my brother and I both took it, the civil service examination in 1948, almost, 2 years after I got out of the Navy, he and I both went to work at the post office. My brother was assistant postmaster, and he died in about 10 years, and I worked with the post office for 35 years.
Wow.
So I would not have gone to work with the post office. I wouldn't have got the job if I had been in the Navy. Mm-hmm. And I was going with my wife then, and didn't have a job that amounted to anything. I certainly couldn't afford to get married. So I went to work at the post office on July 1st of 1948, and I started making big plans. I would not have, so it was a life-changing thing that I went in the Navy. So I started making big plans about getting married, and got married in November mm-hmm. of that. So it was a turning point in my life.
When you were 17 and thinking about going into the Navy, were you thinking all those things that I can go in and it will help me throughout the rest of my life?
Or no, no.
What were your thoughts?
Adventure. And 17-year-old kids don't have any sense.
Weren't you worried that there was a war going on?
Nah, you're not gonna get hurt. But none of my brothers were in any combat. Now I take that back. My brother, that worked at the post office with me, was out on Okinawa before the war was over, and they were bombed. He was a terror control operator, controlling airplanes at the Naha Airport there, and they had a big typhoon. I guess 45 or early 46, and it about blew the. You know what I'm talking about, typhoon.
The weather, yeah.
Okay. Lost everything he had. He blew everything except the clothes he had on his back.
Was he out in it?
On his back. And but none of us were. Other than that, none of us were ever.
Did you write home to your parents?
Oh, yeah. Not as often as I should, I'm sure. Because I didn't know then how much they had valued them. But my mother was very faithful about writing. And my father, going back to boot camp, because I hadn't been in the Navy but about a month, and I called home. We had a line waiting to call home, and I called home, and the family was around on Christmas Day, and I was homesick, and I guess I showed it. And about 4 or 5 days later, we were doing working in the gas chamber, tear gas, and you go in there and put your gas mask on, and you know, teach you how to do that. And somebody came down and said they want to see you up at the guest house. I couldn't imagine that. And I went up there and there sat my father, and it was really a mistake because I couldn't visit with him over an hour, and he'd ridden all the way from Mount Sterling to Chicago, and. I really hated that, but we visited a little bit. But I guess I was so homesick.
That's really sweet.
Yeah, yeah. But I was telling another fellow out there a while ago that was in the Navy, I said, this country is very young. You don't think so, but it is very young. Told him that I have been out of the Navy 62 years. I was born closer to the Civil War than I was when I got out of the Navy. Now think about that. Of course, Civil War to you is 200 years ago.
Coming up on the sesquicentennial. Yeah.
But that just proved to you, and it doesn't have anything to do with this, but the man that built my house, Mason Young, had an uncle that was killed in the Mexican War in 1846. Mm-hmm. 160 years ago.
Yeah.
And now that's getting, as old folks, that's getting back over territory.
Did you find the adventure you were looking for?
Do
you feel like you found the adventure you were looking for?
Yeah, as I told you, it was a turning point in my life and bring back a lot of memories, and I got to see a lot of things that I would never seen. I hadn't been hardly anywhere. Of course, I had a sister that lived in Ohio. I'd been up there, and I went in 1947. I went to North Carolina. My brother's in the Coast Guard down there, and went down and visited him, but I hadn't been anyplace. And I've seen San Francisco, New York City, and Philadelphia, and gone through the canal, and been to Honolulu, and stuff that somebody else paid for.
Well, where did you meet your wife? Did you meet her when you got back?
Yeah. Well, she lived out on Main Street here.
In Mount Sterling?
Yeah, and 1947, I guess they knew they were going to hire us at the post office, you know, taking a civil service examination. And during Christmas of 1947, my brother and I, they called us in, worked us extra, you know, just during the season. And we had a little 1929 Model A parcel post truck. No telling what it'd be worth now. And I forgot it, but my wife lived out on Main Street, and I went out there on Christmas morning and had a special delivery for her, a package, you know, like that. And I'd forgotten it, but that's the first time I ever saw her. We've been married almost 60 years.
So you met her on your delivery route.
Yeah, yeah. Isn't that romantic?
Yes. Very romantic.
Very sweet.
Oh, mercy.
Well, I think that's a good story. I mean, you met a lot of people. You saw a lot of things.
I don't have any trouble talking, do I?
That's good.
Yeah.
That's good.
Yeah. Where are you from?
Originally?
Huh?
Originally?
Yeah.
Oklahoma.
Oklahoma.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What part?
Southeastern.
Yeah.
Yeah, so you went through Norman. You went through Fort, mm-hmm. Not Fort Sill. That's up in, that's the Navy one in Norman.
Yeah. Well, they had at Norman, they had the Naval Air Technical Training Center where mm-hmm. I went. And south of Norman, they had a Naval Air Station. And down at Ardmore, they had a gunnery school. I wanted to be an aerial gunner. Aviation ordnanceman, aviation machinist mason, aviation metalsmith
mm-hmm.
were eligible for aerial gunners.
Uh-huh.
And I applied for that, but I was too tall. I was 6 feet, 2 inches tall.
Oh,
and was turrets and little things like that. And not only that, we worked on airplanes that they'd brought back in from the fleet. Worked on them, sighted in the guns and things like that. And they brought one in there, the machine gun. Holes all in through there. I didn't much want to.
Didn't want to do that afterwards.
Didn't much want to get into that.
Do you still keep up with people that you met while you were on your?
No, I didn't know any of them. There was one other fellow from here in town that went into the Navy with him. He's dead now. But another thing too, it's quite interesting, I think, is that of course I was from people from New York and New Jersey. And Minnesota, a lot of Swedes from up in Minnesota and North Dakota and South Dakota. And incidentally, I found out that they were, the Swedes and the Scandinavians are pretty decent kind of people. I found in the Navy and ever since then, and I don't mean all of them, of course, but you can pretty well depend on what they tell you. New Yorkers in New Jersey, of course, they knew all about Kentucky. They knew we went barefooted down here and drank whiskey all the time and everything like that. They knew all about it, and they ribbed me about it, being from Kentucky. And it didn't take me long to figure out that I tried to be on my best behavior. You know, I didn't want to say ain't, mm-hmm. or I didn't want to add anything to the cold, as it were. And it was a fellow in the Navy up there in boot camp down here in Hazard or Harlan down in southeast of Kentucky, when it was rough down there, you know, down there. And one day I went over there, and he had a crowd of people from up in New York telling about shooting across the street at each other and murdering each other.
No.
I felt like saying, oh, shut up, for heaven's sakes. Oh, mercy. But I remember I've got a picture of my company in boot camp, mm-hmm. and I can remember those faces. I can look at, there's 100 and some people, and I can remember most of them.
Wow.
And some of them I can remember their name. I don't know why that would be, mm-hmm. But.
Do you remember what it was like the day that they announced that the Japanese had surrendered?
Well, it was a celebration.
What kind of celebration?
Everybody started moving around. We went into Honolulu, and I think some of us got a taxi, and we rode around, you know, and waved at people and cheered and everything like that. Yeah. But I tell you what, I went to Moorhead after I retired from the post office, went 3 semesters up there and took some fun courses, you know, geology and stuff like that. Well, English composition wasn't that fun. Anyway, there was some smart aleck, because I was 57 years old, and there were some smart aleck kids there. They got in a philosophy class one day, they started talking about whether we should have dropped an atomic bomb or not. And I realized that I was old enough to be their grandparents, and I tried to guard against being, I know it all, and this is the way it was. They didn't want to hear that. I knew they didn't want to hear that. But you can only take so much, you know. And this black boy from up in New York or somewhere, he talked about dropping an atomic bomb on the Japanese and this and that and other. And I finally said, I want to tell you something. I was on an aircraft carrier in the Pacific. If they hadn't dropped that atomic bomb, I would have been in an invasion of Japan, which they say we would have lost 500,000 men, and I have no doubt that that's true. And I said, not only that, I may not have been here, and you may not have been here, because your grandparents may have gotten killed in the invasion. I said, no, the Japanese and the Germans, and the Germans are working on an atomic bomb too. If they'd have got it, they'd have dropped it on us. And Hamburg, Germany was bombed one night. The British bombed them one night, and we bombed them all the next day. And they had what they call a firestorm. The wind was blowing in over the North Sea, and it just kept, you know, just like a blast furnace, you know, like that. Killed 80,000 people in one night, burned most of them up. They were just as dead as they'd been had an atomic bomb dropped on them. So, you know, everything's relative like that. But
how did he take that?
Huh?
How did he take that when you were?
I don't know. I didn't.
Yeah. Just wondering.
I didn't really care.
Well, do you have any questions that you wanted to add, Linda?
No, you covered what I thought I wanted, and you'd say
I probably told
you're
you
good.
More.
No,
probably told you more than you want to know.
You're a good interviewee. You just.
Mercy.
You just tell it exactly.
But
like
I tell you
it.
What, life has been a good. I wouldn't have missed it for anything. You know, it's interesting.
It sounds like you were very fortunate in being able to play it out like you did and see what you wanted to see and have the adventures without having to do too much combat or
yeah,
any combat.
Yeah.
I mean, it's
well,
fortunate.
Wars are interesting, but you can get killed doing that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, that's a dangerous occupation.
It is. That's why, I mean, being 17 and kind of wistful and ready for adventure, you were fortunate to get what you
well,
expected.
Well, you couldn't get people 35 and 40 years old to do what 17 and 18 year old kids do like that.
Not very often today, can you?
Yeah. Well, I've often said, you're past that age, aren't you? You're not 17, are you?
No.
You're not a teenager, are you?
Not anymore,
you can,
thank goodness.
You can thank me for that if you want to. But I've often said teenagers don't have much sense. That's why the Lord put parents in charge of the land. And when they absolve that, you can see what's happening. That's right. I remember what it's like being a teenager.
Yeah.
They don't have much gumption. Mm-hmm. Too many things going on in their life. And I raised 2 boys, so I know what I'm talking about.
Sense is good.
Well, there is one question I was wondering if you have an opinion about it. I've noticed from talking to all these people that a lot of Mount Sterling boys, Montgomery County boys, joined the Navy,
mm-hmm.
okay, which just seems sort of foreign.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have any idea? I know, well, you joined the Navy because you wanted to be in the, mm-hmm. your brothers were in the Coast Guard, but do you have any other opinion of why so many of them joined the Navy?
No, that's a good question. Never thought about it. I'll wake up 2:00 in the morning, I'll think about that and try to come to some kind of conclusion. This has nothing to do with it, talk about joining the Navy and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
Irene and I have been to Europe 4 or 5 times, I guess. And it has nothing to do with this subject, you understand?
Mm-hmm.
And we would go over to, we were over in France, down here in the, well, we got a World War One marker, the old one. I've got a new one out here. They had one down the courthouse, this marker out here. And the reason they, we had, because the blacks made them take it down, because the blacks from Montgomery County in First World War were down here separate. Mm-hmm. It said colored, they didn't like that. So they made them take it down and put a new one. We brought the old one and put it out here. Mm-hmm. Maybe 30 or 40 names.
Yeah.
On this World War One that got killed in the World War One. Little town is not as big as Mount Sterling. Would have 300 names on it. Mm. Killed in the First World War. And it just wiped out a whole generation of British and French and German. But 20 years later, the Germans were ready to go at it again. I can't understand that. And a little beside that, we were, went to France one time, and we had a tour guide named Peter, who was a British man. And he did a good job. I was really very fond of him. We went down to D-Day beaches first, and down through southern France, and came up back up, going back into Paris through the First World War battlefields. And Peter was talking about what the British and what the French did. And the British don't think we did anything in either war, I don't think. And he was talking about that and never mentioned American. And I told my wife, I said, I can't let Peter get away with this. I told you, I love history. Two or three days later, I said, Peter, this is your tour, and I guess you can conduct it any way you want to. But I must say, I'm disappointed that you didn't mention what the Americans did in the First World War. I said, the Kaiser wasn't about to invade the United States. And I said that we were philosophically aligned with the British and the French more than were the Germans. We tried to help you. And I said, in helping you, we got into the war. And I felt like I hadn't given him a tip yet, and he was kind of a captive audience. And I said, none of that, Peter. We lent you billions of dollars, and you never paid one damn penny of it back. He said, well, I suppose I'll have to take that into consideration. Oh, mercy.
It's still, the conversation still goes on. Well, I'm going to stop this unless you have something else you want to add.
Oh, I'd say something else.
Well, I know you could go on for days.
Not all day. Well, you might as well talk to me or somebody else. Yeah. Yeah. Well, it's been an interesting thing. An interesting thing. And I tell you what, that keeps you. Because I'm 81 years old, and I had somebody the other day somewhere, and I said, "Hell, you know." And I said, "81 years old." He said, "Well, you certainly don't look 81." And I said, "Well, I was careful who I chose as ancestors." My mother lived to be 96, and my brother lived to be 98. And, you've got to stay interested in what's going on around you.
Yeah, that's true.
Absolutely. You're dead and still here.
Well, I just interviewed Mr. Crabtree, and he's 94. So it's.
Yeah, he's a very nice fellow. He's a real gentleman.
Very nice.
Real gentleman.
Well, if it's okay, I'll go ahead and end it here, and we can.
Now, if you publish that and make a lot of money, I'll expect you to share it with me.
That's right. If I make $1 million off of this, you'll be the first one.
And what'd you give me? $10,000.
10%.